shadow follows a curved path on the two-dimensional ground. The mass of the sun curves space-time in such a way that although the Earth follows a straight path in four-dimensional space-time, it appears to us to move along a circular orbit in three-dimensional space. In fact, the orbits of the planets predicted by general relativity are almost exactly the same as those predicted by the Newtonian theory of gravity. However, in the case of Mercury, which being the nearest planet to the Sun, feels the strongest gravitational effects and has a rather elongated orbit, general relativity predicts that the long axis of the ellipse should rotate about the Sun at a rate of about 1 degree in 10,000 years. Small though this effect is, it had been noticed before 1915 and served as one of the first confirmations of Einstein's theory. In recent years, the even smaller deviations of the orbits of the other planets from the Newtonian predictions have been measured by radar and found to agree with the predictions of general relativity. Light rays, too, must follow geodesics in space-time. Again, the fact that space is curved means that light no longer appears to travel in straight lines in space. So general relativity predicts that light should be bent by gravitational fields. For example, the theory predicts that the light cones of points near the Sun will be slightly bent inward on account of the mass of the Sun. This means that light from a distant star that happened to pass near the Sun would be deflected through a small angle, causing the star to appear in a different position to an observer on the Earth. Of course, if the light from the star always passed close to the Sun, we would not be able to tell whether the light was being deflected or if instead the star was really where we see it. However, as the Earth orbits around the Sun, different stars appear to pass behind the Sun and have their light deflected. They therefore change their apparent position relative to other stars. It is normally very difficult to see this effect, because the light from the Sun makes it impossible to observe stars that appear near to the Sun in the sky. However, it is possible to do so during an eclipse of the Sun, when the Sun's light is blocked out by the Moon. Einstein's prediction of light deflection could not be tested immediately in 1915 because the First World War was in progress, and it wasn't until 1919 that a British expedition, observing an eclipse from West Africa, showed that light was indeed deflected by the Sun, just as predicted by the theory. This proof of a German theory by British scientists was hailed as a great act of reconciliation between the two countries after the war. It is ironic, therefore, that later examination of the photographs taken on that expedition showed the errors were as great as the effect they were trying to measure. Their measurement had been sheer luck, or a case of knowing the result they wanted to get, not an uncommon occurrence in science. The light deflection has, however, been accurately confirmed by a number of later observations. Another prediction of general relativity is that time should appear to run slower near a massive body like the Earth. This is because there is a relation between the energy of light and its frequency, that is, the number of waves of light per second. The greater the energy, the higher the frequency. As light travels upward in the Earth's gravitational field, it loses energy, and so its frequency goes down. This means that the length of time between one wave crest and the next goes up. To someone high up, it would appear that everything below, down below, was taking longer to happen. This prediction was tested in 1962 using a pair of very accurate clocks mounted at the top and bottom of a water tower. The clock at the bottom, which was nearer the Earth, was found to run slower in exact agreement with general relativity. The difference in the speed of clocks at different heights above the Earth is now of considerable practical importance with the advent of the very accurate navigation systems based on signals from satellites. If one ignored the predictions of general relativity, the position that one calculated would be wrong by several miles. Newton's laws of motion put an end to the idea of absolute position in space. The theory of relativity gets rid of absolute time. Consider a pair of twins. Suppose that one twin goes to live on the top of a mountain while the other stays at sea level. The first twin would age faster than the second. Thus, if they met again, one would be older than the other. In this case, the difference in ages would be very small, but it would be much larger if one of the twins went for a long trip in a spaceship at nearly the speed of light. When he returned, he would be much younger than the one who stayed on Earth. This is known as the twins' paradox, but it is a paradox only if one has the idea of absolute time at the back of one's mind. In the theory of relativity, there is no unique absolute time, but instead, each individual has his own personal measure of time that depends on where he is and how he is moving. Before 1915, space and time were thought of as a fixed arena in which events took place, but which was not affected by what happened in it. This was true even of the special theory of relativity. Bodies moved, forces attracted and repelled, but time and space simply continued unaffected. It was natural to think that space and time went on forever. The situation, however, is quite different in the general theory of relativity. Space and time are now dynamic quantities. When a body moves, or a force acts, it affects the curvature of space and time, and in turn the structure of space-time affects the way in which bodies move and forces act. Space and time not only affect, but also are affected by everything that happens in the universe. Just as one cannot talk about events in the universe without the notions of space and time, so in general relativity, it became meaningless to talk about space and time outside the limits of the universe. In the following decades, this new understanding of space and time was to revolutionize our view of the universe. The old idea of an essentially unchanging universe that could have existed and could continue to exist forever was replaced by the notion of a dynamic, expanding universe that seemed to have begun a finite time ago, and that might end at a finite time in the future. That revolution forms the subject of the next chapter, and years later it was also to be the starting point for my work in theoretical physics. Roger Penrose and I showed that Einstein's general theory of relativity implied that the universe must have a beginning and possibly an end. Chapter 3, The Expanding Universe. If one looks at the sky on a clear moonless night, the brightest objects one sees are likely to be the planets Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. There will also be a very large number of stars, which are just like our own sun, but much farther from us. Some of these fixed stars do in fact appear to change very slightly their positions relative to each other as the Earth orbits around the sun. They're not really fixed at all. This is because they are comparatively near to us. As the Earth goes round the sun, we see them from different positions against the background of more distant stars. Now this is fortunate because it enables us to measure directly the distance of these stars from us. The nearer they are, the more they appear to move. The nearest star, called Proxima Centauri, is found to be about 4 light years away. The light from it takes about 4 years to reach Earth, or about 23 million million miles. Most of the other stars that are visible to the naked eye lie within a few hundred light years of us. Our sun, for comparison, is a mere 8 light minutes away. The visible stars appear spread all over the night sky, but are particularly concentrated in one band, which we call the Milky Way. As long ago as 1750, some astronomers were suggesting that the appearance of the Milky Way could be explained if most of the visible stars lie in a single disc-like configuration, one example of which we now call a spiral galaxy. Only a few decades later, the astronomer Sir William Herschel confirmed his idea by painstakingly cataloguing and positioning the distances of vast number of stars. Even so, the idea gained complete acceptance only early this century. Our modern picture of the universe dates back to only 1924, when the American astronomer Edwin Hubble demonstrated that ours was not the only galaxy. There were, in fact, many others with vast tracts of empty space between them. In order to prove this, he needed to determine the distances to these other galaxies, which are so far away that, unlike nearby stars, they really do appear fixed. Hubble was forced, therefore, to use indirect methods to measure the distances. Now the apparent brightness of a star depends on two factors: how much light it radiates, that's its luminosity, and how far it is from us. For nearby stars, we can measure their apparent brightness and their distance, and so we can work out their luminosity. Conversely, if we knew the luminosity of stars in other galaxies, we could work out their distance by measuring their apparent brightness. Hubble noted that certain types of stars always have the same luminosity when they are near enough for us to measure. Therefore, he argued, if we found such stars in another galaxy, we could assume that they had the same luminosity, and so calculate the distance to that galaxy. If we could do this for a number of stars in the same galaxy, and our calculations always gave the same distance, we could be fairly confident of our estimate. In this way, Edwin Hubble worked out the distances to 9 different galaxies. We now know that our galaxy is only one of some 100,000 million that can be seen using modern telescopes, each galaxy itself containing some 100,000 million stars. We live in a galaxy that is about 100,000 light-years across and is slowly rotating. The stars, in its spiral arms, orbit around its center about once every several 100 million years. Our sun is just an ordinary, average-sized yellow star near the inner edge of one of the spiral arms. We have certainly come a long way since Aristotle and Ptolemy, when we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe. Stars are so far away that they appear to us to be just pinpoints of light. We can't see their size or shape, so how can we tell different types of stars apart? Well, for the vast majority of stars, there's only one characteristic feature that we can observe: the color of their light. Newton discovered that if light from the sun passes through a triangular-shaped piece of glass called a prism, it breaks up into its component colors, its spectrum, as in a rainbow. By focusing a telescope on an individual star or galaxy, one can similarly observe the spectrum of the light from the star or galaxy. Different stars have different spectra, but the relative brightness of the different colors is always exactly what one would expect to find in the light emitted by an object that is glowing red hot. In fact, the light emitted by an opaque object that is glowing red hot has a characteristic spectrum that depends only on its temperature, a thermal spectrum. This means that we can tell a star's temperature from the spectrum of its light. Moreover, we find that certain very specific colors are missing from star spectra, and these missing colors may vary from star to star. Since we know that each chemical element absorbs a characteristic set of very specific colors, by matching these to those that are missing from a star's spectrum, we can determine exactly which elements are present in the star's atmosphere. In fact, the light emitted by an opaque object that is glowing red hot has a characteristic spectrum that depends only on its temperature, a thermal spectrum. This means that we can tell a star's temperature from the spectrum of its light. Moreover, we find that certain very specific colors are missing from star spectra, and these missing colors may vary from star to star. Since we know that each chemical element absorbs a characteristic set of very specific colors, by matching these to those that are missing from a star's spectrum, we can determine exactly which elements are present in the star's atmosphere. In the 1920s, when astronomers began to look at the spectra of stars in other galaxies, they found something most peculiar. There were the same characteristic set of missing colors as for stars in our own galaxy, but they were all shifted by the same relative amount toward the red end of the spectrum. Now, to understand the implications of this, we must first understand the Doppler effect. As we have seen, visible light consists of fluctuations or waves in the electromagnetic field. The frequency, or number of waves per second, of light is extremely high, ranging from 400 to 700 million waves per second. The different frequencies of light are what the human eye sees as different colors, with the lowest frequencies appearing at the red end of the spectrum and the highest frequencies at the blue end. Now imagine a source of light at a constant distance from us, such as a star, emitting waves of light at a constant frequency. Obviously, the frequency of the waves we receive will be the same as the frequency at which they are emitted. The gravitational field of the galaxy will not be large enough to have a significant effect. Suppose now that the source starts moving toward us. When the source emits the next wave crest, it will be nearer to us. So the time that wave crest takes to reach us will be less than when the star was stationary. This means that the time between the two wave crests reaching us is smaller, and therefore the number of waves we receive each second, in other words, the frequency, is higher than when the star was stationary. Correspondingly, if the source is moving away from us, the frequency of the waves we receive will be lower. In the case of light, therefore, this means that stars moving away from us will have their spectra shifted toward the red end of the spectrum, redshifted, and those moving toward us will have their spectra blue-shifted. This relationship between frequency and speed, which is called the Doppler effect, is an everyday experience. Listen to a car passing on the road. As the car is approaching, its engine sounds at a higher pitch, corresponding to a higher frequency of sound waves, and when it passes and goes away, it sounds at a lower pitch. The behavior of light or radio waves is similar. Indeed, the police make use of the Doppler effect to measure the speed of cars by measuring the frequency of pulses of radio waves reflected off them. In the years following his proof of the existence of other galaxies, Hubble spent his time cataloguing their distances and observing their spectra. At that time, most people expected the galaxies to be moving around quite randomly and so expected to find as many blue-shifted spectra as red-shifted ones. It was quite a surprise, therefore, to find that most galaxies appeared red-shifted. Nearly all were moving away from us. More surprising still was the finding that Hubble published in 1929. Even the size of a galaxy's redshift is not random, but is directly proportional to the galaxy's distance from us. Or in other words, the farther a galaxy is, the farther and faster it is moving away. And that meant that the universe could not be static, as everyone previously had thought, but is in fact expanding. The distance between the different galaxies is growing all the time. The discovery that the universe is expanding was one of the great intellectual revolutions of the 20th century. With hindsight, it is easy to wonder why no one had thought of it before. Newton and others should have realized that a static universe would soon start to contract under the influence of gravity. But suppose instead the universe expanding. If it were expanding fairly slowly, the force of gravity would cause it eventually to stop expanding and then to start contracting. However, if it was expanding at more than a certain critical rate, gravity would never be strong enough to stop it, and the universe would continue to expand forever. This is a bit like what happens when one fires a rocket upward from the surface of the Earth. If it has a fairly low speed, gravity will eventually stop the rocket, and it will start falling back. On the other hand, if the rocket has more than a certain critical speed, about 7 miles per second, gravity will not be strong enough to pull it back. So it will keep going away from the Earth forever. This behavior of the universe could have been predicted from Newton's theory of gravity at any time in the 19th, the 18th, or even the late 17th centuries. Yet so strong was the belief in a static universe that it persisted into the early 20th century. Even Einstein, when he formulated the general theory of relativity in 1915, was so sure that the universe had to be static that he modified his theory to make this possible, introducing a so-called cosmological constant into his equations. Einstein introduced a new anti-gravity force, which, unlike other forces, did not come from any particular source, but was built into the very fabric of space-time. He claimed that space-time had an inbuilt tendency to expand, and this could be made to balance exactly the attraction of all matter in the universe so that a static universe would result. Only one man, it seems, was willing to take general relativity at face value, and while Einstein and other physicists were looking for ways of avoiding general relativity's prediction of a non-static universe, the Russian physicist and mathematician Alexander Friedmann instead set about explaining it. Friedman made two very simple assumptions about the universe: that the universe looks identical in whichever direction we look, and that this would also be true if we were observing the universe from anywhere else. From these two ideas alone, Friedman showed that we should not expect the universe to be static. In fact, in 1922, several years before Edwin Hubble's discovery, Friedman predicted exactly what Hubble found. The assumption that the universe looks the same in every direction is clearly not true in reality. For example, as we have seen, the other stars in our galaxy form a distant band of light across the night sky called the Milky Way. But if we look at distant galaxies, there seems to be more or less the same number of them. So the universe does seem to be roughly the same in every direction, provided one views it on a scale that's large compared to the distance between galaxies and ignores the differences on small scales. For a long time, this was sufficient justification for Friedman's assumption as a rough approximation to the real universe. But more recently, a lucky accident uncovered the fact that Friedman's assumption is, in fact, a remarkably accurate description of our universe. In 1965, two American physicists at the Bell Telephone Laboratories in New Jersey, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, were testing a very sensitive microwave detector. Microwaves are just like light waves, but with a frequency of the order of only 10,000 million waves per second. Penzias and Wilson were worried when they found that their detector was picking up more noise than it ought to. The noise did not appear to be coming from any particular direction. First, they discovered bird droppings in their detector and checked for other possible malfunctions, but soon ruled these out. They knew that any noise from within the atmosphere would be stronger when the detector was not pointing straight up than when it was, because light rays travel through much more atmosphere when received from near the horizon than when received from directly overhead. The extra noise was the same whichever direction the detector was pointed, so it must come from outside the atmosphere. It was also the same day and night and throughout the year, even though the Earth was rotating on its axis and orbiting around the Sun. This showed that the radiation must come from beyond the solar system, and even from beyond the galaxy, as otherwise it would vary as the movement of Earth pointed the detector in different directions. In fact, we know that the radiation must have traveled to us across most of the observable universe, and since it appears to be the same in different directions, the universe must also be the same in every direction, if only on a large scale. We now know that whichever direction we look, this noise never varies by more than one part in 10,000, so Penzias and Wilson had unwittingly stumbled across a remarkably accurate confirmation of Friedman's first assumption. At roughly the same time, two American physicists at nearby Princeton University, Bob Dickey and Jim Peebles, were also taking an interest in microwaves. They were working on a suggestion made by George Gamow, once a student of Alexander Friedman, that the universe should have been very hot and dense, glowing white hot. Dickey and Peebles argued that we should still be able to see the glow of the early universe because light from very distant parts of it would only just be reaching us now. However, the expansion of the universe meant that this light should be so greatly redshifted that it would appear to us now as microwave radiation. Dickey and Peebles were preparing to look for this radiation when Penzias and Wilson heard about their work and realized that they had already found it. For this, Penzias and Wilson were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1978, which seems a bit hard on Dickey and Peebles, not to mention Gamow. Now, at first sight, all this evidence that the universe looks the same whichever direction we look in might seem to suggest that there is something special about our place in the universe. In particular, it might seem that if we observe all other galaxies to be moving away from us, then we must be at the center of the universe. There is, however, an alternate explanation. The universe might look the same in every direction as seen from any other galaxy, too. This, as we have seen, was Friedman's second assumption. We have no scientific evidence for or against this assumption. We believe it only on grounds of modesty. It will be most remarkable if the universe looked the same in every direction around us, but not around other points in the universe. In Friedman's model, All the galaxies are moving directly away from each other. The situation is rather like a balloon with a number of spots painted on it being steadily blown up. As the balloon expands, the distance between any two spots increases. But there is no spot that can be said to be the center of the expansion. Moreover, the farther apart the spots are, the faster they will be moving apart. Similarly, in Friedman's model, the speed at which any two galaxies are moving apart is proportional to the distance between them. So, it predicted that the redshift of a galaxy should be directly proportional to its distance from us, exactly as Hubble found. Despite the success of his model and his prediction of Hubble's observations, Friedman's work remained largely unknown in the West until similar models were discovered in 1935 by the American physicist Howard Robertson and the British mathematician Arthur Walker in response to Hubble's discovery of the uniform expansion of the universe. Although Friedman found only one, there are, in fact, three different kinds of models that obey Friedman's two fundamental assumptions. In the first kind, which Friedman found, the universe is expanding sufficiently slowly that the gravitational attraction between the different galaxies causes the expansion to slow down and eventually to stop. The galaxies then start to move toward each other, and the universe contracts. It starts at zero, increases to a maximum, and then decreases to zero again. In the second kind of solution, the universe is expanding so rapidly that the gravitational attraction can never stop it, though it does slow down a bit. It starts at zero, and eventually the galaxies are moving apart at a steady speed. Finally, there is a third kind of solution, in which the universe is expanding only just fast enough to avoid recollapse. However, the speed at which the galaxies are moving apart gets smaller and smaller, although it never quite reaches zero. A remarkable feature of the first kind of Friedman model is that in it, the universe is not infinite in space, but neither does space have any boundary. Gravity is so strong that space is bent around onto itself, making it rather like the surface of the Earth. If one keeps traveling in a certain direction on the surface of the Earth, one never comes up against an impassable barrier or falls over the edge, but eventually comes back to where one started. In the first Friedman model, space is just like that, but with three dimensions instead of two for the Earth's surface. The fourth dimension, time, is also finite in extent, but it is like a line with two ends or boundaries, a beginning and an end. We shall see later that when one combines general relativity with the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics, it is possible for both space and time to be finite without any edges or boundaries. The idea that one could go right round the universe and end up where one started makes good science fiction, but it doesn't have much practical significance because it can be shown that the universe would collapse to zero size before one could get round. You'd need to travel faster than light in order to end up where you started before the universe came to an end, and that is not allowed. In the first kind of Friedman model, which expands and recollapses, space is bent in on itself, like the surface of the Earth. It is, therefore, finite in extent. In the second kind of model, which expands forever, space is bent the other way, like the surface of a saddle. So in this case, space is infinite. Finally, in the third kind of Friedman model, with just the critical rate of expansion, space is flat, and therefore is also infinite. But which Friedman model describes our universe? Will the universe eventually stop expanding and start contracting, or will it expand forever? To answer this question, we need to know the present rate of expansion of the universe and its present average density. If the density is less than a certain critical value, determined by the rate of expansion, the gravitational attraction will be too weak to halt the expansion. If the density is greater than the critical value, gravity will stop the expansion at some time in the future and cause the universe to recollapse. We can determine the present rate of expansion by measuring the velocities at which other galaxies are moving away from us, using the Doppler effect. This can be done very accurately. However, the distances to the galaxies are not very well known because we can only measure them indirectly. So all we know is that the universe is expanding by between 5% and 10% every 1,000 million years. However, our uncertainty about the present average density of the universe is even greater. If we add up the masses of all the stars that we can see in our galaxy and other galaxies, the total is less than 1/100th of the amount required to halt the expansion of the universe, even for the lowest estimate of the rate of expansion. Our galaxy and other galaxies, however, must contain a large amount of dark matter that we cannot see directly, but which we know must be there because of the influence of its gravitational attraction on the orbits of stars and the galaxies. Moreover, most galaxies are found in clusters, and we can similarly infer the presence of yet more dark matter in between the galaxies in these clusters by its effect on the motion of the galaxies. When we add up all this dark matter, we still get only about 1/10th of the amount required to halt the expansion. However, we cannot exclude the possibility that there might be some other form of matter distributed almost uniformly throughout the universe that we have not yet detected, and that might still raise the average density of the universe up to the critical value needed to halt the expansion. The present evidence, therefore, suggests that the universe will probably expand forever, but all we can really be sure of is that even if the universe is going to recollapse, it won't do so for at least another 10,000 million years, since it has already been expanding for at least that long. This shouldn't unduly worry us. By that time, unless we have colonized beyond the solar system, mankind will long since have died out, extinguished, along with our sun. All of the Friedman solutions have the feature that at some time in the past, between 10 and 20,000 million years ago, the distance between neighboring galaxies must have been zero. At that time, which we call the Big Bang, the density of the universe and the curvature of space-time would have been infinite. Because mathematics cannot really handle infinite numbers, this means that the general theory of relativity on which Friedman's solutions are based predicts that there is a point in the universe where the theory itself breaks down. Such a point is an example of what mathematicians call a singularity. In fact, all our theories of science are formulated on the assumption that space-time is smooth and nearly flat. So they break down at the Big Bang singularity, where the curvature of space-time is infinite. This means that even if there were events before the Big Bang, one couldn't use them to determine what would happen afterward because predictability would break down at the Big Bang. Correspondingly, if, as is the case, we know only what has happened since the Big Bang, we could not determine what happened beforehand. As far as we are concerned, events before the Big Bang can have no consequences, so they should not form part of a scientific model of the universe. We should therefore cut them out of the model and say that time had a beginning at the Big Bang. Many people don't like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention. The Catholic Church, on the other hand, seized on the Big Bang model and in 1951 officially pronounced it to be in accordance with the Bible. There were, therefore, a number of attempts to avoid the conclusion that there had been a Big Bang. The proposal that gained widest support was called the steady-state theory. It was suggested in 1948 by two refugees from Nazi-occupied Austria, Hermann Bondi and Thomas Gold, together with a Briton, Fred Hoyle, who had worked with them on the development of radar during the war. The idea was that as the galaxies moved away from each other, new galaxies were continually forming in the gaps in between from new matter that was being continually created. The universe would therefore look roughly the same at all times, as well as at all points of space. The steady-state theory required a modification of general relativity to allow for the continual creation of matter, but the rate that was involved was so low, about one particle per cubic kilometer per year, that it was not in conflict with experiment. The theory was a good scientific theory in the sense described in Chapter 1. It was simple, and it made definite predictions that could be tested by observation. One of these predictions was that the number of galaxies or similar objects in any given volume of space should be the same wherever and whenever we look in the universe. In the late 1950s and early 60s, a survey of sources of radio waves from outer space was carried out at Cambridge by a group of astronomers led by Martin Ryle, who had also worked with Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle on radar during the war. The Cambridge group showed that most of these radio sources must lie outside our galaxy. Indeed, many of them could be identified with other galaxies, and also that there were many more weak sources than strong ones. They interpreted the weak sources as being the more distant ones, and the stronger ones as being nearer. Then there appeared to be less common sources per unit volume of space for the nearby sources than for the distant ones. This could mean that we are at the center of a great region in the universe in which the sources are fewer than elsewhere. Alternatively, it could mean that the sources were more numerous in the past, at the time that the radio waves left on their journey to us, than they are now. Either explanation contradicted predictions of the steady-state theory. Moreover, the discovery of the microwave radiation by Penzias and Wilson in 65 also indicated that the universe must have been much denser in the past. The steady-state theory, therefore, had to be abandoned. Another attempt to avoid the conclusion that there must have been a Big Bang, and therefore a beginning of time, was made by two Russian scientists, Evgeny Lifshitz and Isaac Kalitnikov, in 1965. They suggested that the Big Bang might be a peculiarity of Friedman's models alone, which, after all, were only approximations of the real universe. Perhaps of all the models that were roughly like the real universe, only Friedman's would contain a Big Bang singularity. In Friedman's models, the galaxies are all moving directly away from each other, so it is not surprising that at some time in the past, they were all at the same place, in the real universe. However, the galaxies are not just moving directly away from each other. They also have some small sideways velocities. So in reality, they need never have been all at exactly the same place, only very close together. Perhaps then the current expanding universe resulted not from a Big Bang singularity, but from an earlier contracting phase, as the universe had collapsed. The particles in it might not have all collided, but had flown past and then away from each other, producing the present expansion of the universe. How, then, could we tell whether the real universe should have started out with a Big Bang? What Lifshitz and Kalitnikov did was to study models of the universe that were roughly like Friedman's models, but took account of the irregularities and the random velocities of galaxies in the real universe. They showed that such models could start with a Big Bang, even though the galaxies were no longer always moving directly away from each other, but they claimed that this was still only possible in certain exceptional models in which the galaxies were all moving in just the right way. They argued that since there seemed to be infinitely more Friedman-like models without a Big Bang singularity than there were with one, we should conclude that there had not in reality been a Big Bang. They later realized, however, that there was a much more general class of Friedman-like models that did have singularities in which the galaxies did not have to be moving any special way. They therefore withdrew their claim in 1970. The work of Lifshitz and Kalitnikov was valuable because it showed that the universe could have a singularity, a Big Bang, if the general theory of relativity was correct. However, it did not resolve the crucial question. Does general relativity predict that our universe should have had a Big Bang, a beginning of time? The answer to this came out of a completely different approach introduced by a British mathematician and physicist, Roger Penrose, in 1965. Using the way light cones behave in general relativity together with the fact that gravity is always attractive, he showed that a star collapsing under its own gravity is trapped in a region whose surface eventually shrinks to zero size. And since the surface of the region shrinks to zero, so too must its volume. All the matter in the star will be compressed into a region of zero volume, so the density of matter and the curvature of space-time become infinite. In other words, one has a singularity contained within a region of space-time known as a black hole. At first sight, Penrose's result applied only to stars. It didn't have anything to say about the question of whether the entire universe had a Big Bang singularity in its past. However, at the time that Penrose produced his theorem, I was a research student, desperately looking for a problem with which to complete my PhD thesis. 2 years before I'd been diagnosed as suffering from ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease or motor neuron disease, and given to understand that I had only one or two more years to live. In these circumstances, there had not seemed much point in working on my PhD. I didn't expect to survive that long. Yet, 2 years had gone by, and I was not that much worse. In fact, things were going rather well for me, and I'd gotten engaged to a very nice girl, Jane Wilde. But in order to get married, I needed a job, and in order to get a job, I needed a PhD. In 1965, I read about Penrose's theorem that any body undergoing gravitational collapse must eventually form a singularity. I soon realized that if one reversed the direction of time in Penrose's theorem so that the collapse became an expansion, the conditions of his theorem would still hold, provided the universe were roughly like a Friedman model on large scales at the present time. Penrose's theorem had shown that any collapsing star must end in a singularity. The time-reversed argument showed that any Friedman-like expanding universe must have begun with a singularity. For technical reasons, Penrose's theorem required that the universe be infinite in space. So I could, in fact, use it to prove that there should be a singularity only if the universe was expanding fast enough to avoid collapsing again, since only those Friedman models were infinite in space. During the next few years, I developed new mathematical techniques to remove this and other technical conditions from the theorems that proved that singularities must occur. The final result was a joint paper by Penrose and myself in 1970, which at last proved that there must have been a Big Bang singularity, provided only that general relativity is correct and the universe contains as much matter as we observe. There was a lot of opposition to our work, partly from the Russians because of their Marxist belief in scientific determinism, and partly from people who felt that the whole idea of singularities was repugnant and spoiled the beauty of Einstein's theory. However, one cannot really argue with a mathematical theorem. So in the end, our work became generally accepted, and nowadays nearly everyone assumes that the universe started with a Big Bang singularity. It is perhaps ironic that, having changed my mind, I am now trying to convince other physicists that there was, in fact, no singularity at the beginning of the universe. As we shall see later, it can disappear once quantum effects are taken into account. We have seen in this chapter how, in less than half a century, man's view of the universe, formed over millennia, has been transformed. Hubble's discovery that the universe was expanding, and the realization of the insignificance of our own planet in the vastness of the universe, were just the starting point. As experimental and theoretical evidence mounted, it became more and more clear that the universe must have had a beginning in time, until, in 1970, this was finally proved by Penrose and myself on the basis of Einstein's general theory of relativity. That proof showed that general relativity is only an incomplete theory. It cannot tell us how the universe started off, because it predicts that all physical theories, including itself, break down at the beginning of the universe. However, general relativity claims to be only a partial theory. So what the singularity theorems really show is that there must have been a time in the very early universe when the universe was so small that one could no longer ignore the small-scale effects of the other great partial theory of the 20th century, quantum mechanics. At the start of the 1970s, we were forced to turn, then, our search for an understanding of the universe from our theory of the extraordinarily vast to our theory of the extraordinarily tiny. That theory, quantum mechanics, will be described next, before we turn to the efforts to combine the two partial theories into a single quantum theory of gravity. Chapter 4. The Uncertainty Principle. The success of scientific theories, particularly Newton's theory of gravity, led the French scientist, the Marquis de Laplace, at the beginning of the 19th century, to argue that the universe was completely deterministic. Laplace suggested that there should be a set of scientific laws that would allow us to predict everything that would happen in the universe, if only we knew the complete state of the universe at one time. For example, if we knew the positions and speeds of the sun and the planets at one time, then we could use Newton's laws to calculate the state of the solar system at any other time. Determinism seems fairly obvious in this case, but Laplace went further to assume that there were similar laws governing everything else, including human behavior. The doctrine of scientific determinism was strongly resisted by many people who felt that it infringed God's freedom to intervene in the world. but it remained the standard assumption of science until the early years of this century. One of the first indications that this belief would have to be abandoned came when calculations by the British scientists Lord Rayleigh and Sir James Jeans suggested that a hot object or body such as a star must radiate energy at an infinite rate. According to the laws we believed at the time, a hot body ought to give off electromagnetic waves, such as radio waves, visible light, or X-rays, equally at all frequencies. For example, a hot body should radiate the same amount of energy in waves with frequencies between 1 and 2 million waves a second, as in waves with frequencies between 2 and 3 million waves a second. Now, since the number of waves a second is unlimited, this would mean that the total energy radiated would be infinite. In order to avoid this obviously ridiculous result, the German scientist Max Planck suggested in 1900 that light, X-rays, and other waves could not be emitted at an arbitrary rate, but only in certain packets that he called quanta. Moreover, each quantum had a certain amount of energy that was greater the higher the frequency of the waves, so at a higher enough frequency, the emission of a single quantum would require more energy than was available. Thus, the radiation at high frequencies would be reduced, and so the rate at which the body lost energy would be finite. The quantum hypothesis explained the observed rate of emission of radiation from hot bodies very well, but its implications for determinism were not realized until 1926, when another German scientist, Werner Heisenberg, formulated his famous uncertainty principle. In order to predict the future position and velocity of a particle, one has to be able to measure its present position and velocity accurately. The obvious way to do this is to shine light on the particle. Some of the waves of light will be scattered by the particle, and this will indicate its position. However, one will not be able to determine the position of the particle more accurately than the distance between the wave crests of light, so one needs to use light of a short wavelength in order to measure the position of the particle precisely. Now, by Planck's quantum hypothesis, one cannot use an arbitrarily small amount of light. One has to use at least one quantum. This quantum will disturb the particle and change its velocity in a way that cannot be predicted. Moreover, the more accurately one measures the position, the shorter the wavelength of the light that one needs, and hence the higher the energy of a single quantum. So the velocity of the particle will be disturbed by a larger amount. In other words, the more accurately you try to measure the position of the particle, the less accurately you can measure its speed, and vice versa. Heisenberg showed that the uncertainty in the position of the particle times the uncertainty in its velocity times the mass of the particle can never be smaller than a certain quantity, which is known as Planck's constant. Moreover, this limit does not depend on the way in which one tries to measure the position or velocity of the particle, or on the type of particle. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is a fundamental, inescapable property of the world. The uncertainty principle had profound implications for the way in which we view the world. Even after more than 50 years, they've not been fully appreciated by many philosophers, and they are still the subject of much controversy. The uncertainty principle signaled an end to Laplace's dream of a theory of science, a model of the universe that would be completely deterministic. One certainly cannot predict future events exactly if one cannot even measure the present state of the universe precisely. We could still imagine that there is a set of laws that determines events completely for some supernatural being who could observe the present state of the universe without disturbing it. However, such models of the universe are not of much interest to us ordinary mortals. It seems better to employ the principle of economy known as Occam's razor and cut out all the features of the theory that cannot be observed. This approach led Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac in the 1920s to reformulate mechanics into a new theory called quantum mechanics, based on the uncertainty principle. In this theory, particles no longer had separate, well-defined positions and velocities that could not be observed. Instead, they had a quantum state, which was a combination of position and velocity. In general, quantum mechanics does not predict a single definite result for an observation. Instead, it predicts a number of different possible outcomes and tells us how likely each of these is. That is to say, if one made the same measurement on a large number of similar systems, each of which started off in the same way, one would find that the result of the measurement would be A in a certain number of cases, B in a different number, and so on. One could predict the approximate number of times that the result would be A or B, but one could not predict the specific result of an individual measurement. Quantum mechanics, therefore, introduces an unavoidable element of unpredictability or randomness into science. Einstein objected to this very strongly, despite the important role he had played in the development of the ideas. Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize for his contribution to quantum theory. Nevertheless, Einstein never accepted that the universe was governed by chance. His feelings were summed up in his most famous statement, "God does not play dice." Most other scientists, however, were willing to accept quantum mechanics because it agreed perfectly with experiment. Indeed, it has been an outstandingly successful theory and underlies nearly all of modern science and technology. It governs the behavior of transistors and integrated circuits, which are the essential components of electronic devices such as TVs and computers, and is also the basis of modern chemistry and biology. The only areas of physical science into which quantum mechanics has not yet been properly incorporated are gravity and the large-scale structure of the universe. Although light is made up of waves, Planck's quantum hypothesis tells us that in some ways it behaves as if it were composed of particles. It can be emitted or absorbed only in packets or quanta. Equally, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle implies that particles behave in some respects like waves. They do not have a definite position, but they are smeared out with a certain probability distribution. The theory of quantum mechanics is based on an entirely new type of mathematics that no longer describes the real world in terms of particles and waves. It is only the observations of the world that may be described in those terms. There is, thus, a duality between waves and particles in quantum mechanics. For some purposes, it's helpful to think of particles as waves, and for other purposes, it is better to think of waves as particles. An important consequence of this is that one can observe what is called interference between two sets of waves or particles. That is to say, the crests of one set of waves may coincide with the troughs of the other set. The two sets of waves then cancel each other out, rather than adding up to a stronger wave as one might expect. A familiar example of interference in the case of light is the colors that are often seen in soap bubbles. Now, these are caused by reflection of light from the two sides of the thin film of water forming the bubble. White light consists of light waves of all different wavelengths, or colors. For certain wavelengths, the crests of the waves reflected from one side of the soap film coincide with the troughs reflected from the other side. The colors corresponding to these wavelengths are absent from the reflected light, which therefore appears to be colored. Interference can also occur for particles because of the duality introduced by quantum mechanics. A famous example is the so-called two-slit experiment. Consider a partition with two narrow parallel slits in it. On one side of the partition, one places a source of light of a particular color, that is, of a particular wavelength. Most of the light will hit the partition, but a small amount will go through the slits. Now, suppose one places a screen on the far side of the partition from the light. Any point on the screen will receive waves from the two slits. However, in general, the distance the light has to travel from the source to the screen via the two slits will be different. This will mean that the waves from the slits will not be in phase with each other when they arrive at the screen. In some places, the waves will cancel each other out, and in others they will reinforce each other. The result is a characteristic pattern of light and dark fringes. The remarkable thing is that one gets exactly the same kind of fringes if one replaces the source of light by a source of particles, such as electrons, with a definite speed. This means that the corresponding waves have a definite length. It seems the more peculiar because if one only has one slit, one does not get any fringes, just a uniform distribution of electrons across the screen. One might therefore think that opening another slit would just increase the number of electrons hitting each point of the screen, but because of interference, it actually decreases it in some places. If electrons are sent through the slits one at a time, one would expect each to pass through one slit or the other, and so behave just as if the slit it passed through were the only one there, giving a uniform distribution on the screen. In reality, however, even when the electrons are sent one at a time, the fringes still appear. Each electron, therefore, must be passing through both slits at the same time. The phenomenon of interference between particles has been crucial to our understanding of the structure of atoms, the basic units of chemistry and biology, and the building blocks out of which we and everything around us are made. At the beginning of this century, it was thought that atoms were rather like the planets orbiting the sun, with electrons, particles of negative electricity, orbiting around a central nucleus, which carried positive electricity. The attraction between the positive and negative electricity was supposed to keep the electrons in their orbits in the same way that the gravitational attraction between the sun and the planets keeps the planets in their orbits. Now, the trouble with this was that the laws of mechanics and electricity, before quantum mechanics, predicted that the electrons would lose energy and so spiral inward until they collided with the nucleus. This would mean that the atom, and indeed all matter, should rapidly collapse to a state of very high density. A partial solution to the problem was found by the Danish scientist Niels Bohr in 1913. He suggested that maybe the electrons were not able to orbit at just any distance from the central nucleus, but only at certain specified distances. If one also supposed that only one or two electrons could orbit at any one of these distances, this would solve the problem of the collapse of the atom, because the electrons could not spiral in any further than to fill up the orbits with the least distances and energies. This model explained quite well the structure of the simplest atom, hydrogen, which was only one electron orbiting around the nucleus, but it was not clear how one ought to extend it to more complicated atoms. Moreover, the idea of a limited set of allowed orbits seemed very arbitrary. The new theory of quantum mechanics resolved the difficulty. It revealed that an electron orbiting around the nucleus could be thought of as a wave, with a wavelength that depended on its velocity. For certain orbits, the length of the orbit would correspond to a whole number, as opposed to a fractional number of wavelengths of the electron. For these orbits, the wave crest would be in the same position each time round, so the waves would add up. These orbits would correspond to Bohr's allowed orbits. However, for orbits whose lengths were not a whole number of wavelengths, each wave crest would eventually be cancelled out by a trough as the electrons went round. These orbits would not be allowed. A nice way of visualizing the wave-particle duality is the so-called sum over histories introduced by the American scientist Richard Feynman. In this approach, the particle is not supposed to have a single history or path in space-time, as it would in a classical non-quantum theory. Instead, it's supposed to go from A to B by every possible path. With each path, there are associated a couple of numbers. One represents the size of a wave, and the other represents the position in the cycle. That is, whether it is at a crest or a trough. The probability of going from A to B is found by adding up the waves for all the paths. In general, if one compares a set of neighboring paths, the phases or positions in the cycle will differ greatly. This means that the waves associated with these paths will almost exactly cancel each other out. However, for some sets of neighboring paths, the phase will not vary much between paths. The waves for these paths will not cancel out, so such paths correspond to Bohr's allowed orbits. With these ideas in concrete mathematical form, it was relatively straightforward to calculate the allowed orbits in more